Hubbub, a chaotic din caused by a crowd of people.
Welcome to Season 5, Episode 2 of the Directors Hub podcast, Hubbub. I'm Faye Miller from Gingerbread World with my co-host Bruce Bignall from Evolve Pipedrive. And today we are talking to Martin Lepard of H2 Productions. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. It's nice to have you on the podcast. Normally, you're behind the scenes doing all the production stuff, so it's quite interesting having you talking to us about what you actually do.
Yeah, it's a strange but becoming more frequent occurrence for me to start appearing on the other side of the microphone for a change, which is nice.
So tell us a bit about H2 Productions and what it is and the services that you offer.
Yeah, so H2 Productions is a all-around event production service. So everything from the technical to the management and everything in between. Basically, we're a wraparound service to help clients deliver events. And we have clients that ask us to do everything. We have clients that just ask us to do one thing. Can you come and do the sound system, the stage, the lights, whatever, the video screens, or like with a certain business show that we run, we come in and take over the management and the delivery of the show. And everything else is done either by venue or by other contractors. So, you know, it varies depending on the client's needs.
So it can be everything from like a podcast like this right up to huge, great absolutely. Big events with thousands
of people. Podcasts, theatre shows, exhibitions, through to concerts, festivals, you name it, we've probably done it.
Yeah, because you've done it for quite a while now, I believe.
Yeah,
2000 you started in?
I've personally been working in the industry, since I was, since I was 14.
Wow.
If you want to get really technical, since I was 6, but that was my dad's fault, using me as cheap labour.
what were you doing at 6? Come on, let's find
so
out.
So my dad used to be a DJ in Brighton. Yeah. He worked at the Top Rank Suite.
Okay.
As promotions manager and a DJ on a Tuesday night.
Is that the one that was...
It's now the Prism, used to be Event.
Oh, yes, yes.
So he was there when I was little, and he was also a mobile DJ, ran a DJ agency. So he had lots of different DJs out on his books, and I used to go out and help him set up bits of kit. And that's kind of how I started getting into it. Like, take all these boxes out of the car and you put things together and stuff happens, and like that box, make that box do that. And if you play with the dials, you can make it do other stuff. And it was kind of being hands-on and putting stuff together and making things out of just this random pile of stuff.
So that's how you spent your weekends as a child then, helping your dad do
DJ sets. And then when I was getting older, because he moved across the road and he was in general manager of the Paradox and Club Barcelona. Oh, so I grew up working there, sort of following light techs around. This is how you service this bit of kit, this is how you do that. And started from there.
So you really did sort of learn on the job, so to speak.
Very much so.
Yeah. So how did it go from being something you did as a kid and a teenager to becoming a business? I mean, what was your first... did you go working for someone else after that?
Or my first proper job in the industry was I worked for a hire shop in Brighton, just hiring things to sort of venues around town. So I was frequently in the Dome and the Corn Exchange, the Brighton Centre and places, but also it was people coming and going, I've got my son's 5th birthday party and I need a mirror ball and a spotlight. And you go, okay, cool, that's all that stuff. And we'd have all that. So I learned, very much sweeping up, making the tea and fixing bits and putting small packages together and building up some bigger things. And then kind of ventured on from there and started working. I did a short stint at the old market in Brighton and then was freelance basically from there. And I'd spent a lot of time working with other companies and for other companies. And, you know, you go out and they go, right, this is how we want you to do this and this is how we want you to do that. And you're delivering these events and going, it's not the best way to do that. Oh, I don't really like the way you've done that, but it's not my place to say because it's your company. So, if I don't like the way you're doing it, I'll do it myself. Yeah. So, and that was it. So I set up my own business, which at the time was just sort of me and someone else. And then we were sharing a warehouse with H2, because H2 used...
What age is this that you're doing this with?
Oh, well, I mean, when I first started as a freelancer, I was, 17, 18? I'd been working as a Saturday boy in the hire shop since I was 14, 15.
Yeah.
My first legal...
Did you know you always wanted to be a...
I think I just, I wanted to... It was where my sort of interest and passion lied. It was the, whatever, particularly academic... but it was what I enjoyed doing, and it was fun and it interested me. And then, went through school and did all that kind of stuff, but it was still, oh, there's a show to do, or there's a disco. I mean, I was doing the school discos before I left school. So I was doing the school discos at my own school while still being at school, which was quite an interesting, and at the time, quite a fun prospect of going back to school and being paid for it. That was quite fun. So kind of it all grew from there, really. So, got into that, got into things. And H2 at the time was actually a customer of mine when it was originally founded. So when I was working at the shop in Brighton, they were a customer of mine because they were founded in 2000 and I was 15, 16. So we used to rent a unit just down the road from here, actually in Ditchling together. And we were sitting alongside each other, both doing the same sort of thing, but more prominent in different sectors of the industry. So we're both leaning on each other to help each other with the other bits. Let's just do it together. So we merged the two businesses, and because H2 was more established, we stuck with H2.
Yeah.
And then that was kind of it. And then onwards and upwards from there, really.
So, yeah, I suppose that's been, 24 years?
It was founded originally in 2000.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's 25 years of the next year. Yeah. And this Christmas marks 18 years in Dubai.
So yeah, tell me about Dubai, because you're obviously Brighton based, but you go all over to do this.
Yes, so we have bases in Brighton and in Lamberhurst, just outside of Tunbridge Wells, and we also have a base in Dubai. So we have equipment and warehouses out there. We also manage the spaces on the QE2.
Okay.
But one of our largest sectors out there is actually theatre production, and we produce our own shows. Largely, with the year coming up to the big C word, is pantos. So we run three pantos a year. I don't know what you're talking about. I know it's Halloween, but still, it's never too early to talk about Christmas. But yes, so we run three pantos a year out there, have done, not three a year, but we've been running pantos out there for the last 18 years.
What, in Dubai?
In Dubai.
They're popular in Dubai, pantos, aren't they?
Very much so.
Wow, I would never guess that.
Well, there's a large expat audience, so there's a lot of English and Irish people working out there. It's also, there's not a lot of family theatre of that sort of genre. You know, there's not stuff that's so audience participation and lighthearted and a bit silly fun.
Yeah.
So it's very much, there is a lack of that. So that's why we've been so popular. We have something like 13,000 people through the doors December across our different shows.
How did that come about? Was it someone that knew you in Brighton and said, oh,
no, so we were, it was another producer that we worked with, and he basically came to us and went, look, I've got a show out in Dubai. I've sent all the kit out, but I've got no one to go and deliver it. Can you help? So we went out and delivered it, and we opened this container of stuff. It's like, build a show out of that, okay? And we did it all, and the theatre management came up to us at the end, and they went, you don't work for Paul, do you? Why ever would you say that? Well, because that's a lot better than what he normally does. Okay, yes, no, we are. We work with him, but we're not the same company. Do you do this yourselves? Yeah, great, can we talk? And from there, that was our first. So we were out there on contract, so basically the venue would buy us as a show, and we would just give them a fixed fee to come out and deliver the show, and that was it. So we weren't producing it ourselves, we weren't promoting it. They would say, right, I want Snow White, I want Sleeping Beauty, whatever. We'd send a container out full of set scenery and all the bits and bobs we'd need. We'd then cast it and get the crew we needed, go out and we'd deliver the show, and then we'd come back. So I'd go and spend about 4 weeks a year.
Just think about this. This isn't just the lights and the staging.
No, that's
this,
what this, I was just wondering. This is the whole...
set, scenery, props.
Yeah.
Do you write the script as well?
We script it, direct it. So Graham, our creative director, who is also Dame, also ex-West End Wendy, so he was in Cats, he was in Barnum, he was in a lot of different things. Yeah, and his daughter and wife are also in the show, so there's a bit of performing heritage there. Okay. But yeah, we literally do the whole thing. It's all our own creations.
Do you ever perform yourself?
I have never.
Ditto Twanky or anything?
Actually, no. I have. I've voiced two characters. Yeah. So our technology and shows develop, a lot of our backdrops, so a lot of the old scenery and cloths are disappearing, and it's all becoming video wall and animation. So some of our shows now have animated backdrops or animated sets, and as such, our Alice in Wonderland production has a tree at the beginning, a talking tree. And then a talking door when Alice shrinks down as she goes down the rabbit hole. So, yes, and they're voiced by myself.
Oh, wow. It must be fantastic for kids, actually, to be fair. Like,
it is, but it's not. I mean, I remember doing, so in 2019, we did a tour in Saudi Arabia for a month. And I remember talking to the promoter, and it was this big thing. And we kind of, having experienced it in Dubai, I knew it was a bit, it's quite an eye-opener for them because it was very different. But it was just, there was this different buzz about it. Mm. And I said, why is it so much more prominent? He said, well, it's one of the first times we've had a license for a non-segregated audience. So you used to have family theatre where the men and the boys all had to sit on one side of the theatre and the women and the girls all had to sit on the other. They weren't allowed to sit together as a family. So they had managed to license these shows that the families could actually sit and enjoy the shows together as a family unit instead of having to be segregated. And I was like, 2019, how are we still living in a world where this is a thing?
Do you ever have to be mindful of that when you're producing the shows and the content?
Oh, we always are. We always have to culturally adapt things in the shows because there are things that just don't, you know, certain jokes, certain types of gags. You can't do fart gags, can't do this and the other. Dames have to be very toned down. They have to dress a different way. There's certain things you can and can't do. So there's lots of different things you have to adapt it culturally to the audience.
It's easier to get a camel on stage.
No, you'd be surprised how awkward it is. We actually also did a show, El Toro, which was kind of a spin-off of Zorro, and trying to get a horse on stage was not a thing, no.
Well, you tried?
No, we did. But getting a horse across the stage that's very polished is not a thing, yeah. Imagine Bambi on ice.
Practical problems then.
Yes, that was quite a thing.
So apart from, obviously Canto's in Dubai, and that sounds really interesting. Tell us a bit more about the kind of the stuff you do in this country, because it's a real mixture. I mean, I know obviously you're intimately involved with the Sussex Business Show, a bit of a plug there for Sunny's show, but, what are the kind of other events that you do?
I mean, it's a real, real broad scope. I mean, we're involved with everything from the BBBC, Brighton Business Breakfast Club, and the networking events there, through to locally, we're supporters of the Barco Carnival, and we sponsored and provided the main stage and technical equipment for that. Things like Worthing Pride, we've done no end of shows and events in the Dome, the Corn Exchange, the Theatre Royal, and then further afield, everything from cooking demonstrations, so we have a live cooking demo set where I've done cooking demos with everyone from Mary Berry to Jamie Oliver to Gino De Campo and everyone in between. We've done...
Who's your favourite chef, then?
Gino gave me a heart attack. Mary Berry's cookies were very nice. James Martin makes a very good cheesecake. Some of them are a lot more light-hearted than others. Jamie Oliver was great. He wasn't even cooking, but he just came up. We had... is it Gennaro? The older Italian chef... Very thick Italian accent, and he's on stage, and they're all kind of mates. He's on stage, and I just get this tap on the shoulder, and I turn around, and it's Jamie, but he's in cut-off denim jeans, T-shirt, baseball cap, bit rosy cheek, because he'd been in the Thatcher's tent with his mate Jamie. Flip-flops on, and he just said, have you got a spare microphone? And I said, yeah, why? He said, hand out. I said, I'm going to go around the back. When I put my hand up, turn it on. I said, okay, fine. So I'm backstage, and I'm trying to pick my head round. Gennaro's on stage, he's talking away, very thick Italian accent, and then just Jamie puts his hand up and he stands up at the back of the audience. Put your hand up if you can understand a damn word he's saying. Not quite his words, but I'll tone it down. And it just got a laugh, and everyone sort of turned around, and suddenly Jamie's in the middle of the audience, and Gennaro was kind of taken aback, and they looked up and was like, oh God. So Jamie walked down and got on stage and sort of started ad hoc interviewing him on stage while he was cooking, and it was just all very fun and lighthearted. So... Yeah, I mean, there are people that you work with who you kind of go, oh, they're going to be a nightmare, and then they pleasantly surprise you.
Yeah.
There's people you work with that you think are going to be really nice, and you go, oh, that was quite a disappointment.
Yeah, my brother works in the film industry, and he said the same thing about some of the people he's worked with. I'm not naming any names, but he, the ones you think would be really nice turn out to be assholes.
I mean, touch wood,
turn out to be brilliant.
With all the, like we used to do Middle East Film or Comic Con, things like that, with all the different people I used to meet, don't have anyone that I was kind of, you were a bit off. Carl Urban was a bit grumpy, but I think that's because he'd had not a lot of sleep. Otherwise, generally, everyone's been quite nice. It's usually amazing how different people look to on camera.
Yeah.
I met Michael Rooker from Guardians of the Galaxy and Walking Dead and things, and he stood up to say hello and shake my hand. And I went, oh, he said, what? I said, they shoot you from low quite a lot, don't they? Because you're a lot taller on screen. And he literally came up to like here on me. I was like, oh, okay. He's all torso and not a lot of leg.
That's true. But, there's so many of them are much smaller in real life than they appear on screen.
I'm six six.
But, you know, you see him on the screen, you see him in all these action films and The Walking Dead and things like that, and he's towering over people, and he's quite broad, and he looks quite big, and then he stands up, and he's not short, but because of the way he's shot on film, you think he's taller than he is. I mean, he was a great guy, had a fantastic sense of humour, but, yeah, and he was really quite receptive to me going, well, you're kind of short, aren't you? You know, yeah, some people might not have taken it so well, but, yeah, he was very sort of understanding about it was quite funny. And I remember we had, it was the year that Netflix were launching their Lost in Space reboot, and I had I never watched it, so I don't know the guy's name. It was the guy who played I was on the side, so we had the cast on stage and I was off to the side with getting the next guy ready, and it was the guy who played Hodor in Games of Thrones. I don't know his name, but he was like, apparently he was a bit of a character. Anyway, there's the young lad playing Will Robinson sitting on stage talking about how he grew up with them, you know, all these sci-fi things like the Aliens franchise and stuff. And I looked at each other and went, I've got socks older than this kid. He's like 12 and he's talking about how he grew up with Aliens. That came out before you were even a twinkle in your dad's eye. I grew up with it. It was quite funny. So, yeah, there's some people are just very down to earth, very nice characters, and it's not a lot of bravado and stuff, which is quite nice.
Brilliant. So, sort of moving on, it sounds like you've done some amazing things, Martin. But I suppose just wondering how COVID impacted it, because I guess your job is very much face-to-face events and everything, and COVID must have like had a serious impact.
Absolutely. Yes, I had a very stressful and sleepless couple of years. you know, we were watching companies 20 times the size of us disappearing overnight, and I was getting emails every other day about liquidation auction for this company, that company. They're huge.
Yeah,
that's a multi-million pound company, and we're sitting here and we're just getting by. I mean, because we also do installation work, we just beginning of 2020 had just had a sign off for a £250,000 installation for a project in Brighton that we were working on, so that kept us going. But also our virtual side skyrocketed, so people think that virtual events became a thing in 2020. They very much did not. It was just that technology wasn't in the same place as everyone's budget. So we used to do a lot of events for people like GlaxoSmithKline, big pharma companies who had deeper pockets. And you know, when you say, okay, to put that online is going to cost you £150,000, they went, okay. But because of the stakeholders they're working with, and because of when they go, well, the cost to get everyone together or to do it like that, actually it's negligible, so they would do it. Now, we all carry a TV studio in our pockets. You can go live at the push of a button and connect with everyone in the world. So technology has come down, so you don't have to have a studio with 70 people to put something online. You can do it with a lot more streamlined. So we were doing online events for everyone from Corn Foods, AXA Insurance, Adidas Golf, TikTok for Business. In the space of 2 years, we must have delivered over, I'd say we were probably averaging 3 events a week.
So were they sort of clamouring for these events to be put on at that point? Because everything had gone virtual a lot of the time.
Yes. I mean, it was very different depending on the market and the product or the service that they were doing. So, for example, with Corn, we were doing small 20, 30 person Zooms where it was product releases and product launches or focus groups, where actually it wasn't about the size of the audience, it was about how critical getting the info out to those 30 people were, or getting their feedback, because it helped steer what they were doing next. Then we had other businesses like TikTok for Business, so we were doing everything from different part of platform launches, integration launches and everything, and it was all regional, so we would be doing Spain and then Germany and then Europe.
Into team?
So there was B2B elements, so we were doing launches into those regions of TikTok and Shopify. TikTok is now integrated with Shopify, and this is how you can make the most of it. Different not quite masterclasses, but strategies on how to integrate TikTok for business and how to make the most of it. We did then do a town hall meeting. So we did a business-wide town hall for TikTok, which we had something like 3,000 people on a Zoom call. We dialed in the director from California, dressed as a llama, because apparently that's what they do. And yeah, we hosted a town hall with all of the TikTok audience, or all the TikTok team dialed in from around the world, which was quite funky. And then we did we delivered their first two online seminars, which were five streams of content simultaneously broadcast with a sort of keynote sections in between. So that was quite a full-on experience.
I was going to say, how do you even, well, I mean, you're an expert in it, but how do you even go to start organising something of that magnitude?
So essentially, we took a conference and worked it back. So yeah. They had, right, okay, we're going to have a main seminar, which is going to have a section in the middle. There'll be a fun section in the break in between, and then there'll be the closing section. And the closing section is going to be an interview with that person. The opening is going to be this, and then we'll break down. So we're going to have, I think we have five topics throughout the day, but each topic was then regionalised. So you had the main seminar was all in English, and then we broke down and had English, French, Spanish, Italian and German channels. So section one would be automotive, and if you were in the French channel, it was TikTok speaking to Citroën. And if it was the Spanish channel, it was TikTok and Sayat, for example. So it was all still tied back to TikTok, but it was made more localised by then tying it into the region. Yeah. Four of the five streams were pre-recorded. So for a month pre the event, yeah, we had three studios running five days a week, back-to-back, doing remote records. So we would dial in the host, we would dial in the guests, and we'd pre-record all of these sessions, port the footage over to the editing teams in the US, and they would send back a complete package of, right, this is stream one, seminar one, stream one, stream two, seminar one, and so on and so forth. So all of those were pre-recorded. Yeah. And then the English stream was all live on the day in the studio in London. Okay. So we were mixing live hosts, live entertainer, and a pre-recorded quiz with four other streams of pre-recorded content. So we all had to then be time-aligned so it'll broadcast at the right time, finish and stagger back, and then all start again. So yeah, we had 20 people on site with the live studio, 8 people in the studios in Brighton with the pre-records. Yeah. Our producer and show caller was based in Seattle. We have a web-based comm system, so basically it was like you would normally have your talkback, but she was on her laptop in Seattle watching the stream on her screen, and we were all based between London and Brighton, and we could all talk to each other at the push of a button.
Gosh,
that's actually crazy, isn't it, to think they're able to direct the show or kind of be the stage manager from over there. You said video conferencing didn't start in COVID, we know that. Were people doing that then?
Not quite to that extent, yeah, because as I say, the tech wasn't there. Mm. You know, if you wanted to dial someone in, it was usually a Zoom call or something that you had to link in. The platforms weren't as comprehensive as they are now. The tech behind it all wasn't as comprehensive as it is now. So if you look at the sort of increase or the advancements in video conferencing tech, follow the trajectory up to 2020, yeah, and then post 2020, and you see that the line takes a bit of a steep incline.
Yeah. What's the most surprising thing when running, when you said you're having 3,000 people on a Zoom? Like, I didn't even know you could do that. Like, so what's the, are there limits to having the number of people on? Like, as a layman, like, I don't know.
It all comes down to how and where you broadcast it and what your expectations are. You have to pre-plan in advance because you have to have some kind of indication of, is it going to be 300 or 3,000 people? Yeah. Because you have to prepare the platform ahead of time. Otherwise, there's not sufficient computing power behind the platform, and then suddenly 3,000 people log on and your platform screeches to a halt because you didn't prepare us for this. So you have to do all that sort of pre-planning in advance and get an idea of how many people are going to be there. So a lot of it is, it's pre-registration stuff. People go, why am I pre-registering for a virtual event? There's a very good reason. Mm-hmm. So all that has to be factored in because obviously that has an incremental cost. But you can do it a lot of the platforms now, even Zoom, with the introduction of Zoom events, they all realised in response to what was happening during 2020, 2021, well, we can make our platforms more versatile. people are already using it for this. Let's keep them here for this. You know, I have no doubt that both of you went on at least one Zoom call during 2020 and went into a breakout room.
Twice.
Exactly. And that was the thing that became one more prominent feature during COVID. It was a thing that you could do, but it wasn't quite as accessible or as well set up as it was before 2020. And then that has expanded, and then collaborative teams came, or collaborative tools came in, and all of this other stuff was added in response to, we've now got most of the world coming to our platforms or relying on our platforms for X, Y, and Z, and then realizing and you know, seeing that hybrid working on remote access is going to be a commonplace thing moving forward. Right, let's make our tools the most comprehensive there so that people stick with it.
So how have you found it since then? Because obviously the world has moved on from COVID and things have largely gone back to normal, I suppose. But in terms of what you do, do you find that a lot of the companies, like you say, like TikTok and that, because they've got people spread all over, are they still more inclined to do events like this because it's actually more cost effective for them to sort of do it and dial in rather than actually physically bring people to a location to hold an event?
It very much depends on the event and the content.
Yeah.
There are actually a lot more smaller events are either still transitioning to hybrid or staying hybrid, purely on the basis that their content is, they might be smaller organisations with a smaller reach in whatever region they're in, but nationally or internationally, it might be that actually there's a lot more appeal for what they do than they realise, and someone being able to go, you know what, I can't get to Edinburgh for a day and a half for that conference, but I'll happily pay £50 to watch it online, or I can't, you know, go to Dubai for that 3-day summit, but I can watch all the things I want to watch online. There was this shift in realisation that actually, outside of COVID, right, we're back to live events, but people realised they saw probably a 50 to 60% increase in their audience figures over the number that would normally come through the door. And then when you look at where they're located, you suddenly realise we've got audiences in places we never used to have an audience from, because people in Australia going to the Dubai Retail Summit for 2 days, that's an £8,000 return flight. But for $300 to watch it online and I just have to get up a few hours earlier, I'm happy to do that.
The addressable market is huge. Like I join Zooms at 10 o'clock sometimes if I want to learn about the event that's running.
Exactly. So it's the accessibility. It's suddenly realising that, yes, we still need to get people through the door because these events cost money, and actually there is something about an in-person event, and it's very much, you know, the conversations and the networking, it's very different in person to online. But when you then say, well, let's just ignore that online audience that wanted to access our content, they realise that actually, you know, we're cutting off a big chunk of audience, which then when you say, okay, well, we can do a reduced price ticket. Well, in fact, scroll it back. You look at producing the event, you go, okay, well, I've got a stage, I've got cameras, I've got screens. You've got 80% of the equipment you need there to put it online. It's not like you're suddenly going, we're redoing the event from scratch to put it online. You're adding in a small amount of additional kit and personnel to bridge that gap. And then when you go, okay, so we've put that online, we might get 3,000 people. Well, that's great, because online you've suddenly got new sponsorship opportunities. Mm-hmm. You can say, right, well, we'll get a sponsor in for that. They can brand it. You can have ad reels in between all the sessions, etc. We'll put, you know, put your own logos on the entire stream. Great, you funded that. Tickets can be at a fraction of the cost, but it helps to fund it, but it gets you a wider audience. And then when these shows go, actually, okay, well, look, we're realising there's a big audience in this region that is way too far for us to come, but actually, is there enough of an audience there that we put up a new show? And we do, right, we do a Dubai show, and we do an Australia show, or we do a Europe show, because they won't travel because it's too far and the economics don't balance out for the 3 days, but actually there's enough of an audience there that we do another show, and we can still put it online because it will work the other way, that the Dubai audience or the Australian audience will dial back into that show, because if the content's different and the audience is different, they'll learn something new.
So there's massive scope with it for, as you say, extending reach and finding new audiences and increasing your market reach, I guess, for whatever
Absolutely.
Business you're in.
Absolutely. I mean, the possibilities are endless. I mean, there's all sorts of weird and wonderful things you can do. We had one event where the agency that we were working with came up with an idea, pitched it to client. Client loved it, signed off on it. Didn't actually speak to us first to see if it was physically possible.
Okay.
So they went, yeah, so we're just going to put live comments up on the stream during the stream. And I went, okay, how are we doing that then? we'll just we'll make an image and send it to you during the. So you want us to download artwork, import untested artwork to a live broadcast while it's going on, and just hope that it's all going to work fine. You kind of see the problems of that, don't you? They're, right, give us 24 hours. And we went away and we came back. I said, right, okay. Here's a link to a Google Sheet. And there are four lines of four columns, two columns, four lines. And went, okay, I said, right. Column one is the comment. Column two is the name. You do that. And we'd built, basically, an animated lower third that I could go, right, fill in column A. Tell me when you've done it. They would do that. It would populate and update the live broadcast. Yeah. So we could then put the animated lower third up and it would pull up that content.
After being pre-screened.
Yes. So they would act as they were the moderator, essentially. Okay. So they're looking for the content. They find the comment. They put it in. Literally, they type it in within seconds because it was all going through Google Sheets and Google Data Verification. It would link to Google. Google would pull the data off into the broadcast system and done. So within 5 seconds, they could have pulled the content off. We push a button and it's on screen. It worked because it wasn't relying on us downloading or importing anything. All it needed was the internet link we already had because we're broadcasting to pull the data off the Google Sheet. Yeah, once we did it, it was kind of like, oh, it's quite cool that we did that. Didn't really like that we were being forced to do that.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, it's the pressure of having to find a solution.
Well, I guess that's sort of pivoting very quickly on the spot, isn't it?
Yes.
I suppose you probably would like to have had a bit more time to work on it.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. But yeah, there was a lot of, okay, well, we've worked out that bit. How do we do this bit? Okay, we've worked out that bit, but it's broken that bit. Okay, go back and fix that. The kind of thing that you normally try and do and have a few days or at least a week of time to... Yeah. Build, test, and implement. Okay, 24 hours, let's do it.
So are there any other things like that where you've had to deal with where it's tested your abilities to get it up and running quickly, or you've got clients asking you for really strange stuff that you've had to think twice and think, how am I actually going to do that?
Blimey, we've done all manner of weird and wonderful things.
What things stick in your mind most, Martin?
That's a very good question. What things have biggest challenges. We've had all sorts of. A fun one even to now is still the various different venues in Dubai, because lots of thought goes into certain elements and not so much thought goes into others. There's the one venue on top of the Mall of the Emirates, which is the in Dubai, which is the mall with the big indoor ski slope. Yeah. Fantastic theatre, double height fly floor, beautiful, I think it's 600 seat auditorium, 40 foot loading doors on the side. On the roof of the mall, which is only accessible by the car park, which has a height limit of 2.9 metres for a vehicle. So you can't get anything 40 foot anywhere near the building because it doesn't fit. You can get into the basement, but again, there's a height restriction on the trunk you can get in there, and the lift is only 13 feet corner to corner if you put it diagonally. So whereas you could put a lovely full height set in, you can't because you can't get it to the building unless you build it on site. And then if you do build it on site, you can't take it out because it won't go anywhere past the door. And it's things like that. With the venue in Cairo, where the loading access was something like 45 stairs with one landing outside. Working in Dubai International Trade Centre, and part of their green policy is we don't put the air conditioning on in build days. You realise it's 48 degrees and we're in a warehouse and there's no air. Yeah, we're saving energy, and people are dropping like flies. So, yeah, there's lots of sort of quirky challenges. There's lots of fun challenges. We had we did a promotional tour with Asahi Beer years ago, where we toured the world's first robotic barman up and down the country.
Barman,
yes. Yeah, it was a full torso with two Denso robotic arms. It could pour pints, open bottles, and pour half-pint samples, serve them to you, and it could talk.
I was going to say, how's the chat? Was it?
It was me hiding around the back with a radio mic on, so I was everywhere from...
That's his other voiceover job as well.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I was going through a voice changer and stuff, so I sounded like a robot, so you really couldn't tell it was me unless I knew it was one I'd done. So we did various events at like Asda and Selfridges and Sainsbury's, took it on Market Kitchen, took it into various different venues in central London because they have a lot of big accounts in there. So trying to navigate a 2.5 metre square, 3/4 of a tonne robot around... around the country was, quite a challenge.
So where do you see this sort of going in the future, your business, and what kind of events you'll be involved in? Will it be more of the same, or you got any different directions you want to go in at all, Martin?
I think it's going to be, I mean, it will be more of the same, because it's just basically kind of as it is. I think we shifted our business model, so we sort of work on more, we focus more on projects than on just anyone that wants to come and hire a bit of a kit, because a lot of that small work makes you busy with no money. It extracts the money from your bigger work. Yeah. So being able to focus on projects like Barco, like Worthing Pride, like the Games Cons, the Comic Cons, all that kind of stuff. I think I see more of that. I think it's as I say, 25 years. I just hope there's another 25 years. You know, it's just seeing it.
I've wrote here. You still bloody love it.
Well, the hours we do and the things you have to put up with. If you didn't like it, you wouldn't be here, because none of us are getting rich.
but there's the 6-year-old kid that's connecting things, pulling out a box, pulling stuff out.
Didn't have a clue then that he'd be getting up at 1 in the morning to start work and coming back at 2 in the morning the next day, having just finished work, and then the prospect of a few hours sleep to then go and do it again somewhere else.
Because you care so much about making sure that a good job's done.
It's about the quality of the show, ultimately it's about the show must go on, right? Whether it's a theatre show, whether it's an exhibition, whether it's a conference, whatever, the show must go on. And the thing always for me has been, as an attendee, you turn up to an event, whatever it is, if the speaker system doesn't work, if the projector's not working, if the lights aren't on, if the stage isn't built, you don't think, oh, the staging company's messed up. You think the event's messed up. You think the organisers, oh, it's a bad organiser, it's a bad show, or it's a bad venue. Someone else gets the blame for the people behind the scenes. And for me, it's very much, because we're behind the scenes of lots of stuff that people don't know we're behind the scenes of. The point is, people don't know it's us, and people wouldn't think it's us. You just immediately go, oh, that concert was rubbish because of Blur. Well, it's not because of that contractor messed this up, or that show was rubbish. Yeah. And what I don't want is a customer to have a negative impact because of something that was down to us. Yeah. The show must go on, and it's got to go on to a good level. We see so many people that will go out there and go, yeah, we delivered that. And you go, there's going through the motions and there's delivering a show. Yeah. You went through the motions. And that's, for us, that's what it's about. We'd bring the passion, the creativity of the theatre side through to the attention to detail and the polished delivery of a corporate event to all of our events. So whether it's a festival in a field, whether it's a theatre show, whether it's a business expo, whatever, we bring the same mindset and skill set to everything we do.
So how long does it take to plan some of these shows? I mean, you said you moved towards more project-based sort of concentrating on projects rather than little bits of work, which makes sense. But these projects, are they sort of a year in the planning, 2 years, 6 months, or does it vary?
It can be months, it can be years. Yeah. We've got an event next, end of next July, beginning of August, that I've been in the planning for since last August.
Wow. Is that just purely because of the sheer amount of logistics involved?
It's the logistics of it. I mean, it's an event that never actually came back from COVID. For a myriad of different reasons, not to do with the show, but more venues and suppliers messing them around. So it's kind of bringing it back from COVID, but the nature of the show, it's Europe's biggest military revival show, so you're dealing with weapons and vehicles and planes and reenactors and all sorts. So there's a myriad of things. And then dealing with venues, it's licensing, it's number of campsite pitches you can have and all of this kind of thing. So there's a whole myriad of things that have to be done in the background before you even get to take bookings or start to sell tickets.
And suddenly you're like, oh, it's 6 months away.
It's still only 6 months, man. I've been working on this for a year and a half and we're still only 6 months away. But it's all of this kind of stuff there where it's one of the things that people go, oh, you work in events, you must get to go, lads. No. And we see people coming into the event industry that go, oh, yeah, because it's like, you're focusing on the 5%, which is you see gigs and go, this looks like a big fan. What you don't realise is to go to that gig that you've seen, these people have been here for anything up to a week before, doing 12 to 18 to 20 hour days to get the gig to happen. And then they've still got another 7 hours work to do at the end of the gig, and then they're coming back the next day to do another 12 hours. And then when you suddenly throw them into that scenario, they go, oh, there's a lot of work in this, isn't there? Yes, there is. It's not just, oh, look, turn up and there's lights in the stage and sound and loads of people. And it's, yeah, it's great, it's fun. That bit is fantastic. But it's the work before and the work after. That's so the
have
thing.
You been really, really impressed with the Taylor Swift world tour?
That's quite the actually, have you seen the Adele Munich residency?
No.
So they set up the world's largest temporary, well, it won a Guinness World Record for the world's largest temporary video screen, temporary TV screen. It was something in the region of about 300 metres long. It was huge. Video wall. And the production, the scale that went into that was fantastic. I mean, it's tricky for me. Going to events and gigs is a bit like a busman's holiday, so it really has to be stuff that I really want to see. Or if it's technical, it has to be really technically impressive.
You go to see
impressive.
A show like that, even if it's not your musical taste, to be like, I want to see this
If
show.
It was something like that, I would love to go and see the Adele. That I would love to have gone to that residence just to experience the technical delivery, because it was so insane. I love the idea of going to the Sphere in Vegas, because a lot of the acts that are on are not necessarily my taste, but the technical prowess of that space is really impressive, and I'd love to see it and experience it. So yeah, there are certain elements of, I would go there for the technical side of it, but then on the flip side, there are certain shows I would go to and go, I'm not worried about, I will try and switch off my tech brain because I want to see that person or that band or whatever. So
are there any, is there any particular project, or what would, I'm not going to say your greatest achievement so far, but are there any particular projects that you are particularly proud of that stand out for you over the course of the last 25 odd years?
There's lots of different things. There's lots of little moments.
Yeah.
So there's no kind of one big, oh, that thing. But they don't happen very often. So it's kind of like mental snapshots of, that's a really cool moment. That's a really cool moment. So I've got, meeting some of my favourite film actors at the Comic Cons and things, fantastic stuff. When we did Big Beach Boutique 4 on Brighton Beach, so the last one before he moved his gigs up to the stadium, being on Brighton Seafront with 25,000 people, 4 foot from Fatboy Slim, we've put in all the sound system, we've done all this, and I'm standing there going, this is quite cool, this is an achievement. And in the back of my mind, it's just proving my old PE teacher wrong, who said to me when I was leaving secondary school, you need to get involved in some more social activities and some more team things. You'll never make a career out of playing with speakers and lights. Okay, so this is just a little token, fresh black. This is me not making a career out of speakers and lights. Got that? Perfect. So it's just, there's a few moments like that where it's like that. I've got a photo of somewhere like with me, with Jamie Oller and Steve Martin and Gino De Campo all backstage at one of the cooking demos. I've got some interesting memories with... Brian Connolly. That's not the Scottish one, is
no,
it?
No, it's the comedian.
Yes.
Yeah,
the comedian.
Yeah,
we did a one-man show with him, and I mic'd him up, and he was wearing, when I walked into his dressing room after being invited in, he was wearing nothing more than his wife fronts and a pair of socks. That was an experience. But he was very light-hearted about it, which is funny. But yeah, it's just, there's lots of little moments. So there's cut out the Fat Boy Slim one really stands out for me, because it's like it's a home gig, and it's one where
it's pretty iconic, really, isn't
it? Yeah, it's a great gig to be able to go, we were behind that, or we were part of that, and it's not necessarily one that people know that we were part of, but I go,
I have to say, I didn't know you were part of it, but it's one that you can tell the grandkids one day, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, yeah, not that I necessarily know that my grandkids are going to know what it's is, but it's one of those things where it's like, I was part of that, and I did that, and I've been there. We did another one that was. Phone call was, it's a party for 50 people. Band, three-piece band playing 45 minutes during dinner. Okay, great. The 50 people are Elton John and his guests at his house, because he's having a private party for GQ Men's Fashion Week. So I spent a day at Elton John's house.
Nice.
So, yeah, lots of weird and wonderful experiences.
Oh, brilliant. Well, what a way to wrap up the podcast, I guess, because we're coming to the end of it now. It's been fantastic talking to you, Martin, and hearing all about... your business and your experiences.
It's been great talking to you and not being sat in the corner producing for a change.
Plenty of wonderful stories, and for the longest time, from being behind the screen to hopefully we see and hear more of you on the front of the screen as well.
We shall see.
And where can we find you?
So HG Productions, you can find us on all the socials at HG Productions UK, and you can find me, Martin Leppard, on LinkedIn, on Facebook, I think I'm on Instagram somewhere. Apparently.
Well, brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hubbub, the Directors Hub podcast, sponsored by the Sussex Business Show.